You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Devil to Pay by William D. Cohen. At Yale, Lampert made connections that would be important to his future. His membership in the elite secretive fraternity Skull and Bones opened to him a rarefied world inhabited by the likes of George W. Bush and Stephen Schwartzman, now CEO of the Blackstone Group. The holy grail among this set was Goldman Sachs, then, as now, Wall Street's most prestigious firm. The summer after his junior year, Lampert got a highly coveted Goldman Sachs internship. It probably hadn't hurt his chances that Mnuchin's father, Robert, was one of the firm's senior partners, in charge of the equity division. After graduation, Lampert ended up in the risk arbitrage department at Goldman, reporting directly to Robert Freeman, the partner in charge of the firm's business of buying and selling stocks involved in takeover transactions. Eddie just had a drive and ambition amongst a group of pretty ambitious guys that I thought was unique, Freeman says. He was like a young bucking bronco on a fast track to be successful. In February 1987, Freeman was led off the trading floor at Goldman by a U.S. Marshal and arrested outside the firm's Broad Street headquarters on charges of insider trading. If you were at Goldman Sachs and you were a person working for Bob Freeman, you probably saw your career flashing before your eyes, says a former Goldman colleague. Eventually, Freeman pleaded guilty to one felony count of insider trading and ended up serving 4 months in a minimum security prison in Pensacola, Florida. Lampert gave a deposition in the case, but was never implicated in any wrongdoing. It was certainly an experience that Lampert wishes had never happened, and one that he learned a great deal from, says Lampert's spokesperson. After that experience, Lampert resolved to leave Goldman Sachs. During the summer of 1987, he met Texas billionaire investor Richard Rainwater on Nantucket. Over lunch, Rainwater told Lampert, "There is life after Goldman." Lampert took the advice to heart. A year later, he left the firm and started ESL with $28 million in seed money from Rainwater. The fund, Lampert explains, was dedicated to long-term investing, something he claims few others aside from his hero Warren Buffett were doing at the time. Rainwater also introduced Lampert to important future clients, such as Geffen. Within a year, though, Lampert and Rainwater had a falling out. According to the Wall Street Journal, their dispute was about ego, strategy, and turf. He's so obsessed with moving in the direction he wants to move that sometimes people get burned, trampled on, bumped into, Rainwater said of Lampert. I think he has gone about alienating himself from almost everyone who he's come into contact with. A former colleague agrees. He's really an extreme guy. There's something odd about him, I think. His lack of emotional connection to people. It's so important, but some people just don't have that. They're off in their own little world. AutoZone was Lampert's biggest coup. After acquiring 30% of the company, he orchestrated a series of aggressive stock buybacks that had the effect of driving up AutoZone's earnings per share by reducing the shares outstanding. The stock price went through the roof. In 2012, he sold his stock for between $500 and $600 per share for a total of around $1.5 billion. For people to say he knows nothing about retail is a little tiresome. because in AutoZone he made a bundle of effing money, says Tiger Williams. But there is a big difference between retailing auto parts and selling the thousands of diverse products, from pajamas to tractors to cosmetics, offered by Kmart and Sears. Nevertheless, Lampert's success with AutoZone led him to believe he could handle rescuing Kmart, which had been fighting a losing battle with the big box stores such as Walmart. In 2003, he bought the majority of Kmart's debt before the company went into Chapter 11, after which he took control of it. He immediately set about reducing inventory in the stores, slashing expenses, and cutting back on advertising. Lampert has a view, which he shares publicly, that he doesn't believe in the traditional manner of how retailers run their business, says Cohen. He thinks investment in stores is not appropriate. We were focused on getting each store profitable and running each store well, Lampert explains. The plan, he says, was for the world to know that Kmart, which at this point was not in debt, had undeniable financial strength. Even people who didn't think Kmart would last a year out of bankruptcy, they said, well, Kmart may still not be successful, but I get you're not going out of business anytime soon with all that cash. At 7:30 p.m. on January 10th, 2003, the Friday before the week during which the finishing touches were to be put on the Kmart reorganization, Lampert went to get his car in the garage of his Greenwich office building. Suddenly, he was shoved into the back seat of a rented black Ford Expedition sport utility vehicle and driven, blindfolded, and handcuffed to a Days Inn 55 miles away in Hamden, Connecticut. Four young men held him hostage for the next 28 hours in a $49-a-night room. They told him that unnamed AutoZone officials had offered to pay them $3 million to murder him, and they taunted him with a shotgun. On Saturday morning, two of the kidnappers used Lampert's credit card to go on an $800 shopping spree for electronics equipment. Lampert and two of the kidnappers, who had stayed behind at the Days Inn to guard him, settled on a $5 million payoff. On Sunday, at around 2 a.m., one of the kidnappers drove him back to Greenwich and led him out on a highway off-ramp to get the money, according to published reports. Why they would have made such a stupid move has not been answered until now. Lampert, who had not slept in days, walked the half-mile to the Greenwich police station. Tracing the stolen credit card transactions, the kidnappers had also purchased a pizza with one. Police arrested four local men soon thereafter. Rinaldo Rose, a 24-year-old ex-Marine, Shimon Gordon, 23, Devin Harris, 19, and Lorenzo Jones, 17. In the years since, Lampert has not talked publicly about the kidnapping, nor have the more puzzling aspects of the case been cleared up. When I ask him about it, he frowned. "You're not going there, are you?" he says. "I don't really want to talk a lot about it for a lot of reasons, but I know it's not an unimportant event." All he'll say is that the experience was not good, and they could have made a different decision. Let's put it that way. "Did it change your life?" I ask him. "Yeah, yeah," he says. "I'm just not comfortable talking about it." In 2004, Rinaldo Rose, the ringleader, was sentenced to 15 years in prison. He was released early in July 2016 and returned to his native Jamaica, where he now runs the Foreign Ink mobile tattoo studio out of a van. Reached by phone, he willingly gave his version of the kidnapping. He recalls that after serving in the Marines, He hooked up with some friends, and they were already doing jobs. They encouraged him to focus on wealthy local targets, and he read about Lampert in a news article that showed he was one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest, at the time. Rose says that after being abducted, Lampert freaked out, and one of the guys started punching him in the head, so I had to yell at them, "Listen, you both calm down, keep quiet, and you're going to be all right." I made Lampert a promise, "Listen, you don't give us no problem, and we'll let you go." And he did, so he never freaked out again after initially. It still haunts Rose today that he might not have gone to prison had he killed Lampert and the other kidnappers. So it was either like, okay, get rid of everybody. But with Shimon Gordon, Lampert was like family almost. He argued against all that. I still think we should have just got rid of everybody, but I don't know. I did have to consider that. Lampert never gave any problems, so I kind of had to keep my word on that. Rose dismisses the idea of the AutoZone executives offering $3 million for Lampert's murder as the fabrication of one of his cohorts. But he recalls an intriguing exchange that he says took place between Gordon and Lampert. "I heard Eddie. I heard some of the discussions, because there was even a discussion when it came to him buying Kmart. He was asking questions such as, 'When I get out of here, do you think I should do it?' He said he felt that Kmart was tied up with something with the mob or mafia. They used it as a piggy bank. That was the first time I'd ever heard it. I'm like, shit, the mafia is still around? But he was really hesitant about doing it." Through his spokesperson, Lampert denies he made such comments. In the end, Rose says, the main reason he decided to let Lampert go was that his partners were so inept. By using Lampert's credit card against Rose's instructions, his partners in crime had alerted police to their whereabouts. Rose says they released Lampert not to get the ransom money, but to call off what was by then a hopeless caper. The next week, Lampert completed the Kmart deal and soon set about his cost-cutting strategy. It yielded results. His cash flow exploded, and he was being touted by the financial media as the next Warren Buffett, remembers Cohen. In 2003, Lampert says, operating profit was around $400 million. The next year, it was $900 million. In 2005, he decided that Kmart should buy Sears. Kmart was a turnaround, he says. Putting Kmart and Sears together was a transformation. Lampert explained his strategy for the combined company. When we put Sears and Kmart together, part of the idea was we had all of these Kmart stores that were off-mall, he says. Sears was sort of stuck in the mall. And Sears, before we made the acquisition, was starting to move off-mall. Lampert's vision was to keep Kmart and Sears stores as close to Walmart as he could get them. That's where all the people in town are going, he says. He believed that Sears and Kmart were differentiated enough from Walmart to be complementary, not competitive. He says he invested a lot of capital in Kmart stores, but didn't get a return on his investment. I'm not sure Kmart on its own could ever be a great retailer, he says, but you put Kmart and Sears together. In combination, they had a chance. Kmart had the locations, and Sears had the brands. Lampert also says that starting in 2006, he began making countercultural investments in online commerce. I'm told for about 2 years, Lampert actually attempted to run the business, says Cohen. So for about a year and a half, or 2 years, the financial performance of Sears Holdings looked pretty good. But in fact, all that he was doing was completely cutting capital expenditures and operating expenses. Lampert's spokesperson responds, "Managing capital expenditures and expenses tightly has been required, not optional, to improve the company's operating performance and financial flexibility in order to achieve its long-term transformation." The combined company never really found its niche, which was supposed to be somewhere between Walmart on the low end and Macy's on the high. And then came the 2008 financial crisis, when, according to Cohen, Lampert stopped appearing to support the business in any conventional way and started to invest free cash flow in derivatives. He hived off Sears Roebuck 3 consequential brands, Kenmore, Craftsman, and Die Hard, into a Caribbean-based, wholly-owned sub of ESL, so the company was paying royalties to Eddie Lampert for the use of its own trademarks. Lampert's spokesperson calls this completely false. There is no Caribbean-based, wholly-owned subsidiary of ESL, nor any subsidiary, nor any payments to ESL or a subsidiary of ESL for any of the trademarks. The company has been in steep decline ever since. There are a lot of decisions made over a long period of time, including by me, that may not have been always the best decisions, Lampert admits. But I did have a point of view in terms of how shopping habits were going to change. I could have put a lot of capital in a Kmart or Sears store, and it could look like Bloomingdale's, or it could look like Saks. But we didn't have access to products that would be consistent with that. In other words, if I built an equivalent of Nordstrom's, it's not like all of a sudden Nike would be selling to us, or that Nordstrom's customers would be coming through his doors. Instead, he says, he targeted his capital on improving his customers' online experience. I did believe that people are going to be one click away from the best possible experience, the cheapest price, and whatever product they want, he says. And I could have a better website than Nordstrom's. I could have a better website than Bloomingdale's. In other words, I don't need to invest in fixtures, but I do need to invest in the features and the experiences. But Lampert was evidently ahead of his time and trying to get Sears buyers to shop online. At the time, they were just not comfortable enough with the technology to do so. Whatever the reason, Sears' website never remotely rivaled the sales in the stores or on Amazon. Now that Amazon is eating Sears' lunch, Lampert is faced with his latest challenge, staving off a Sears Holdings bankruptcy, and he is using every corporate finance strategy in the book. In addition to making billions of dollars in loans to the company to provide Sears Holdings with more cash, he has announced the closing of some 300 more stores since the beginning of 2017. He sold Sears' Craftsman line of tools to Stanley Black & Decker for around $900 million. He is considering the sale or monetization of the Die Hard Battery and Auto Center brand. Most of the big transactions that he's been into, like the sale of Sears Canada stock or the sale of Land's End, have involved or are caught up in special dividends where he's taken the cash out and returned it to shareholders, argues Cohen. And of course, he's the principal shareholder. Lampert has spun off Land's End, Sears Hometown and Outlet Stores, Sears Canada, and Orchard Supply, each into its own public company. "We're fighting to survive, that's pretty clear," Lampert says. His critics see things differently. Robert Chapman, a California-based hedge fund manager, calls Sears Holdings a total shit show that is in secret liquidation mode. He says he recently came out of a Kmart in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that offered so many bargains he couldn't believe his eyes. He's not calling it a liquidation sale, he says of Lampert. But if you've gone into one of the stores, it's a liquidation deal. Cohen says Lampert is a guy who may have harbored some notion of running this business, but if he did, he's pivoted to just simply manipulating it, if you will, for his own benefit. This is the creative destruction of a very weak brand, Kmart, and a perfectly viable brand, Sears, both of which together were doing something like $50 billion when he took over. And he's getting away with it, because he's been able to treat this like a private company. No public company would ever allow a chief executive officer to remain in their seat who was so intimately tied to these manipulations and presiding over the failure of a business like this. This is not normal. If anything is normal these days, this is certainly not normal. Cohen believes that a bankruptcy filing is inevitable, and that Lampert will end up benefiting from it because he will be able to walk away from onerous store leases and other liabilities, such as the underfunded pension plan, and get rid of those assets that he hasn't been able to sell. Since he's the largest Sears Holdings creditor, Cohen says, he'll then bring this thing right back out as a new company, and he'll become the new shareholder, and he'll start this process all over again, because Sears still has a substantial inventory of at least theoretically valuable real estate. And as long as there's any plus value to any consequential outcome, it's all to his benefit. For his part, Lampert says he is going to keep fighting for as long as it makes sense. I believe in what's possible, and we're doing things that are necessary to keep the company going. It's definitely not just humbled me, but it's expanded my awareness of real issues that exist in our society. I feel like I can make a contribution by being involved, okay? Cohen takes a more cynical view. This is all just a perversion of our free market system, he says. This is the actions of a controlling shareholder treating a company as if it is truly private, with no oversights, no constructive oversight whatsoever, with no intent to protect any of the requisite constituencies other than essentially himself. Lampert's spokesperson says, there is no merit to the speculation that Mr. Lampert is working to benefit from the liquidation, failure, or bankruptcy of Sears Holdings. All shareholders and the board of directors that represents them ensure there is oversight of their interest in the Sears Holdings, as do several other stakeholders, lending partners, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, vendors, employees, members, etc., who have their own different interest in the company. So it is untrue and unfair to allege that the company is being manipulated to only serve the interest of Mr. Lampert. Despite Lampert's optimism, Sears continues to decline. Many other big box retailers had a surprisingly robust 2017 holiday sales season, but sales at Sears suffered mightily, down around 17%. Lampert once again tried to reassure the company's suppliers and equity holders that it had enough cash to pay its bills as they became due. On January 10th, he announced that he had arranged an additional $300 million of new loans to ease the terms on other loans that Sears already has, in order to buy more time. He also announced that Sears would find another $200 million in cost savings not related to already announced store closings. Nevertheless, the fourth quarter 2017 loss could be as much as $320 million, and Lampert announced he is going to close another 103 Sears and Kmart stores by this month. Despite everything, The Sears Holdings stock price has slumped to $2 a share, down considerably from the high of $134 per share some 11 years ago. Sears Holdings now has a market value of around $250 million, making Lampert's nearly 60% stake worth $150 million. At the end of our interview, Lampert made it clear he's not done yet. Put it this way, if I consider all the other alternatives, they're not great for a lot of people, and I just want to be responsible. If I didn't believe that this company could be transformed still, the window is definitely shrinking, but if I didn't believe that, I would try to take a different path. But I don't know what that path exactly would be. It's not a question of giving up or not giving up. Now for the Proust questionnaire, with an illustration by Risco, Cecile Richards. As she steps down after 12 years running Planned Parenthood, the veteran activist, whose book, Make Trouble, is out next month, reveals the meaning behind her blue Shirley Temple cup and her affinity for the witches of Salem. What is your current state of mind? Fired up, ready to go. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A taco truck on every corner. Which historical figure do you most identify with? The witches of Salem. Which living person do you most admire? United Farm Workers organizer Dolores Huerta. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Impatience. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Patience. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Smugness. What is your greatest fear? Steep cliffs. What is your greatest extravagance? Extra virgin olive oil and my KitchenAid mixer with pasta attachments. What is your favorite journey? Hiking the Inca Trail in Peru. On what occasion do you lie? Only when asked how much butter is in the pie crust. Which living person do you most despise? Politicians legislating away women's rights. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? There's no way Donald Trump tweeted that, and that he's still president. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband and fellow organizer Kirk Adams, and our rescue dachshund Ollie. When and where were you happiest? January 15, 1991, walking up Congress Avenue in Austin with thousands of others to see Mom sworn in as governor of Texas. What is your greatest regret? That my mother, Ann Richards, didn't live long enough to be on Twitter. What is it that you most dislike? Papaya. Which talent would you most like to have? Playing the alto saxophone. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My three wonderful kids, Lily, Hannah, and Daniel. What is your most treasured possession? My blue Shirley Temple cup. The Reverend Billy Graham baptized my mom with it when she was a girl. Where would you like to live? Rome. What is your favorite occupation? Making trouble. What is your most marked characteristic? A penchant for saying things that piss people off. What do you most value in your friends? Discretion and love of New Orleans, my favorite city. These two go hand in hand. Who are your favorite writers? Haruki Murakami, Ann Patchett, and Barry Unsworth. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Tintin. Who are your heroes in real life? The doctors, nurses, and staff at Planned Parenthood health centers across America. What are your favorite names? Today, Sonia, Elena, and Ruth Bader. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A yoga goat or a therapy pet? If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? A sea otter in Monterey Bay. How would you like to die? With my boots on. What is your motto? If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Cecile Richards.
Thank you.
Voices of a Revolution. In April 1968, hundreds of students at Columbia University took over campus buildings in an uprising that caught the world's attention. 50 years later, they reflect on what went right and what went wrong. By Clara Bingham. At Columbia University in April 1968, about 1,000 students forcibly commandeered 5 campus buildings, effectively igniting the mass student revolts of the 60s. The events that began haphazardly on April 23rd soon grew into a public crescendo of awakening that changed the course of the American student protest movement. It was a year when political, racial, sexual, and cultural forces exploded into a revolutionary volcano, as novelist Paul Auster, then a junior at Columbia, described it. It was also the year when 2 widespread movements, civil rights and anti-war, combined forces to stoke a flame of youth rebellion not seen domestically in half a century. That spring, 50 years ago, Columbia's compact, 6-city block campus on Manhattan's bohemian Upper West Side became a petri dish, fermenting and fomenting discord that would engulf the nation. By the end of the year, American deaths in Vietnam exceeded 35,000 soldiers. Anti-war protest multiplied. The draft continued to loom like a sword of Damocles over the lives of 27 million young men. The peaceful civil rights movement intensified, along with the increasingly militant Black Power movement. The sexual revolution and early feminism movement transformed gender roles. And the unstoppable popularity of psychedelic drugs and rock music, the musical Hair opened on Broadway that month, created an unbridgeable chasm of a generation gap. All of these movements for social change, including the conservative counter-revolutionaries, were out in full force on the Columbia campus that April. University President Grayson Kirk was a walking anachronism, says Paul Cronin, editor of the new definitive book on the Columbia student uprising, A Time to Stir, Columbia, 68. He was clueless and unresponsive to the attitudes, needs, and demands of his students. It turns out that Kirk and his board of trustees, members of New York's corporate and media elites, were as out of touch with youth culture as President Lyndon Johnson and his FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover was so threatened by what he saw at Columbia that in May he ordered his agency to initiate a secret counterintelligence program, 2,000 FBI agents strong, aimed at anti-war demonstrators and the new left. Not since the Berkeley Free Speech Movement in 64-65 had a campus of a major university been shut down by its students. The student rumblings of 1968 started in February, when 2 Black South Carolina State University students, protesting a segregated bowling alley, were shot and killed by state troopers in Orangeburg. A 3rd young Black man, a high school student, was also killed as he waited to walk his mother home from work. In March, students at the historically Black Howard University in Washington, D.C., staged a 4-day protest and sit-in. But Columbia captured the attention of the nation because of its stature as an Ivy League college, situated in the media capital of the world. The protest was so large, 720 students arrested. It lasted so long, a week of building occupations, followed by a month-long strike, and the police reaction was so brutal and bloody that it was seared into the national conscience. As tens of thousands of high school students all over the country organized demonstrations demanding gun control reform from politicians in the wake of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, we may now be witnessing the first full-fledged American student protest movement since the late 60s. I got chills when I heard Emma Gonzalez speak about her generation's fledgling movement to stop gun violence, said former 68 Barnard Columbia Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, activist Nancy Bieberman, a lifelong housing and social justice advocate in the Bronx. Bieberman is heartened by the new wave of protest that has roused high school students from decades of apathy. Imagine that a student movement might emerge again and play a catalyzing role in ending the slaughter of innocent people. In the photos, Students for a Democratic Society members, including Ted Gold and Mark Rudd, a Columbia SDS button, a scene from the protest. University President Grayson Kirk and Vice President David Truman in the aftermath of the unrest. Activist Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown speak to the media. On April 12, 1968, Grayson Kirk, Columbia University president, wrote, "Our young people, in disturbing numbers, appear to reject all forms of authority from whatever source derived, and they have taken refuge in a turbulent and inchoate nihilism whose sole objectives are destruction. I know of no time in our history when the gap between the generations has been wider or more potentially dangerous." Mark Rudd wrote on April 22, 1968, "Dear Grayson, you call for order and respect for authority. We call for justice, freedom, and socialism. There is only one thing left to say. It may sound nihilistic to you, since it is the opening shot in a war of liberation. I'll use the words of Leroy Jones, whom I'm sure you don't like a whole lot. Up against the wall, MF, this is a stick-up. Yours for freedom, Mark." Juan Gonzalez, Columbia student activist, "You cannot understand the Columbia student revolt without understanding that it happened 3 weeks after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed on April 4th. At that point, it wasn't a question of what career you were going to choose. It was a question of whether the country would survive a civil war." Mark Rudd, Columbia student, SDS leader, "It was the perfect storm in terms of the events of the late winter, early spring of 68. The three events were the Tet Offensive, the abdication of LBJ, and the murder of Martin Luther King. Those major events politicized everyone on the Columbia campus." Robert Friedman, Columbia student, Columbia Daily Spectator editor, "It was a time of growing frequency of protest on campus over issues having to do with the draft and Columbia's involvement with something called the Institute for Defense Analyses, IDA, which was a think tank that was doing war research for the Pentagon." Rudd, "At Columbia, the organizing dovetailed with all these political events, so that on April 23rd, we called a demonstration at the sundial in the center of campus to protest the fact that six people, including myself, had been reprimanded for a previous demonstration against Columbia's affiliation with the IDA. Paul Auster, Columbia student, "The Vietnam War was driving everyone crazy. Things were cracking apart, and you felt that chaos was ruling now. Nobody knew where we were going. The frustration of not being able to stop the war led me out to the sundial that day." Eleanor Stein, Columbia Law School student, "It started off as a protest about the disciplinary procedures against the IDA, six, but it quickly became about both the gym and about the university's ties to the IDA." Stuart Goodell, Columbia student, SDS member, "The thing that was different about April 23rd was that the black students, the Student Afro-American Society, SAS, and the SDS had agreed to speak at the same demonstration, and this was completely new. Arneem Johnson, Columbia student, SAS member. I remember on April 23rd, when the movement started, we were protesting the gym that Columbia was building in Morningside Park. There were a lot of community objections to the gym, mainly because it was being built on a public park that Columbia had muscled from the city. Morningside Park is one of the few parks in Harlem. The university said the gym was going to be mixed use, but it really wasn't. The Columbia people would enter on the top floor. The Harlem neighborhood people would enter on the bottom level. It was very bad visually, so the Harlem community was pissed off, and the black students were pissed off. Nancy Bieberman, Barnard student, SDS member. The two strands of anger and disgust converged, what the university was doing to aid the war effort and what the university was doing that was racist in our neighborhood. Brian Flanagan, Columbia student, SDS member. In the Columbia SDS, there were two factions, the Praxis Axis and the Action Faction. The Praxis Axis believed in door-to-door organizing, the writing of manifestos, and teach-ins about Vietnam. The Action Faction was Mark Rudd, J.J., John Jacobs, and other people, including me. We believed in brazen action and tools that electrified people and upped the ante, and that faction took over the Columbia SDS in March of 68. Rudd, we met at noon at the sundial. There were speeches. There was somewhat of a plan that the SDS had developed to stage an indoor demonstration at the building which housed the office of the president, Lowe Memorial Library. But there were so many people, perhaps 500 at the sundial, including several hundred counter-demonstrators between us and Lowe Library, that there was no chance to actually carry out the plan. Oster, finally someone said, let's go to the gym site. Next photo, protesters outside the barricaded Hamilton Hall, dubbed Malcolm X University, April 27th, 1968. Raymond Brown, Columbia student, SAS leader. The students were trying to rip down the 12-foot-high chain-link fence around the gym site, and some of the cops got in a wrestling match with the students, including a couple good friends of mine. Normally, that would have led to arrest, but this old sergeant stepped in and separated them. Rudd, we left the gym site and went back to the sundial, and our runner came back and said Hamilton Hall is open, so I said, let's go to Hamilton Hall. That was the main Columbia College classroom building, and also where the dean's offices were. So we all streamed in. It was several hundred people. Gidal, the idea was that it was a sit-in, and that we would stay until we were arrested. A group of us started scouting out the rooms on the first floor, and there's Dean Henry Coleman in his office. He had interviewed me when I applied to Columbia, and I said, you can't leave. He said, what? I said, you can't leave. We pulled the door shut and posted a good friend of mine who was a lightweight football player and three other people to keep the door closed. Coleman opened the Venetian blinds of his window, which looked onto College Walk, and he got someone to get him an ice cream. Brown, Cicero Wilson, Bill Sayles, Drew Newton, Mark Rudd, Juan Gonzalez, Ted Gold, Nick Freudenberg, and I formed a steering committee, and we began to say, if we're going to have a real demonstration, we've got to whittle down a set of succinct demands. What are common demands that we can all embrace? There was a back-and-forth process that took much of the day. Rudd, we wrote up a list of six demands, the first one being to drop disciplinary action against the IDA 6, then to stop the construction of the gym and disaffiliate from the IDA, and the last, to grant amnesty to everyone participating in the demonstration. These demands became the rallying point of the whole strike. Brown, the core of the SAS Black Student Group, about 20 of us, plus some sisters from Barnard, was organically more disciplined because we were smaller in number and knew each other well. Rudd, the occupation of Hamilton Hall was totally spontaneous, but hundreds and hundreds of people streamed in. People started bringing food, and militants came in from Harlem. There were rumors of guns, and the steering committee kept meeting, but at one point the blacks started meeting alone and caucusing. Johnson, there came to be a growing friction between the SDS people and the SAS people, mainly because the white people didn't know what they were doing. Their hearts were in the right place, but logistically they didn't have it together at all. Brown, we knew that we, the black students, occupied a key strategic place, that the university administration didn't want to move on us, and this would keep the whole thing going. During the course of the day, it had dawned on us that we were going to have to go at it alone, with support from the white students in some other way. Our leadership's obligation was to make sure that none of our people got hurt, and we asked the white students to leave. Rudd, it wasn't a complete shock, because that was the era of black power, and the idea of separation was very current. Now, the real reason why they asked us to leave, it turns out, was that they couldn't deal with the SDS's lack of discipline. They needed some form of hierarchical leadership which would prepare them for the harsh confrontation that might be coming. Carla Spurlock Evans, Barnard student, SAS member. This was the year when we were moving toward a very outspoken declaration of cultural pride, a separation from being enthralled with a European ideal. It just goes back to Hamilton Hall in many ways, where we said we can be part of the same struggle, but we as black people have to call the shots for ourselves. Lowe Memorial Library. Rudd, we left Hamilton Hall just before dawn, straggling out with our guitars, book bags, and sleeping bags, and wandered over to Lowe Library with a vague notion of going into the president's office. Goodall, we're chanting, IDA must go, IDA must go, Jim Crow must go. Next photos. Professors surround Lowe Memorial Library in support of the students occupying the building. Police bust the protesters, April 30, 1968. Majority coalition members protest the protest outside Lowe. And Paul Auster during the uprising. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.